Good morning, everyone. This is the conference, for the record, this is the conference committee for Senate File 1143 and the corresponding language with the House. And for the record, we do have quorum. And we'll be going over a side-by-side very briefly and then on to making decisions on differences. Would the staff like to review the bill on differences, or how would you like to proceed? You don't want to say a word, I know.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, if you'd like, we can just highlight the substance, the main substantive differences.
That's fine.
And if you're working off the side by side, the first place really is on R21. And if you look at on the House language on the right-hand side of Section 37 there, and then also on the top of the next page, Section 38. So this makes puts in statute that legal fees to defend the legislature are public, and then the other provision deals with settlement agreements involving legislative employees.
Representative Scott, do you think what we should do is, as we go through the differences on the bill, make action on those differences as we proceed, or do you want to go through the entire bill and then we'll back up to those?
I think that we should go through the entire bill.
All right. Let's do that.
And, Mr. Chairman, the next major difference is on R22. And this is just a little difference. This is the unofficial fiscal notes. And it's more just a stylistic difference if you look at the sort of the last sentence on both sides in terms of when the unofficial fiscal note becomes public. The Senate language refers to any legislation, if it's used for any legislation, including an amendment or proposed bill that's offered in the legislature, where the House refers to any portion of any other bill. I think the same intent is there. It's just a different way to word it. Mm-hmm. And the next difference is on R29. And this is a Senate Section 65, the design, build, transportation project data that is not in the House bill. And then also on R30, you've got the Senate Section 67, the mileage-based user fee data that is not in the House bill.
Was there an explanation of what that information was going to be used for? I can't recall.
Mr. Chairman, this is a provision from last session, actually, that passed the Senate in another bill. And I think this is a program that's in operation right now or being implemented. And this would class, and I believe this was actually part of a Department of Transportation bill initially, and this would classify the data as private.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'm not sure it passed last year. The House was pretty adamant about this program and not wanting the program to go forward and not giving them the authority to make this information private. And I believe MnDOT just went ahead with the program. They had a temporary classification, I think, from the department, failed to get the legislative approval of that classification. And I believe they are implementing the program with the current situation that that information becomes public. So this is one where they needed to get some information or some legislation to do it right and protect the public's information. And rather than waiting to implement the program and get the necessary language to make sure that the data would be protected, they just went ahead with the program. So here we sit.
Yeah.
I'll speak for myself, not very happy.
The record will reveal that Representative Holbrook is not happy.
And there are MnDOT people here in the room if anybody.
All right.
Or if we'll they'd keep, like to we'll correct anything I said.
All right.
And
thank you for
Mr.
that.
Mr. Chairman, as yes. Representative Holbrook mentioned, there is a temporary classification. It is actually good till 2013. So if he didn't do anything this year, that would still be in effect. But if he didn't do anything next year, then it could become public. So.
Okay.
And the next one is on R37 and R38. This is at Energy Programs. And there's just one little difference. If you look at the top of R38, actually, under the Senate language, the commissioner may use the Social Security number of an individual to determine whether they're eligible. The House language limits it to the last four digits of the Social Security number.
One thing to keep in mind is I have begun to see certain businesses now requesting the first five digits of a Social Security number. Now, that may seem rather innocent, but when you know that there's information harvester-type companies around, it's just a matter of time before they get both segments of the Social Security number and merge them together. So it's just something to remind ourselves on public policy making that that's something that's going on right now. We'll keep going.
Mr. Chairman, members, and the next is on R40, at the top of the page, Senate section dealing with federal secure communities initiatives. And it both requires the state to participate in the initiative and then specifies that the data are criminal history data. That's not in the House bill. And the next difference is on R45. And this is the amendment to the personnel data statute, which classifies kind of personal contact information on employees of contractors or subcontractors as private data. If you look at the House language that appears on 8.27 and 8.28, it says that it shall be disclosed for prevailing wage law enforcement purposes. And then on R46, this is the open meeting law notice requirement. And under the current Senate language, it requires that this web notice is only in effect for a regular meeting notice, but not a special meeting notice where the House applies to both regular or special meetings. And then go to R46, and this is the DNR, electronic licensing data system. And the main difference between the two bills is that the House has more permissible uses for the data. In particular, like if you look on the House side on R47, Clause 5 for use in research activities, there's also a requirement, like if you look on 34.15 and 16, that for insurers, if a person requesting it is an agent, they have to provide the insurance company's name. Similarly, on 34.22 and 34.23, there's a requirement that a person provide a copy of their private investigator license. And the main substantive difference in the House is probably Clause 9, which allows use of the data by lake associations. And then Clause 10 just specifies it can be released with written consent, which is the general law anyway. So. And then the final, if you go to R48, let's see here. There's a House-only provision. Well, actually, it starts at the beginning, at the bottom of R47 into R48, and this is the dependent audit language that's in the House bill but not in the Senate bill. And that also tied to that is the House repealer that's on 36.11 and 36.12, which repeals the session law from last session that created the audit. And then the final difference is also in the repealer. If you look at on the House side on 36.9 and 10, this repeals a law classifying certain data of the IRRRB on program recipients as private data. That's not in the Senate bill.
All right. Any questions so far? Any suggestions on how we should proceed?
Well, Mr. Chair, are we going to take any testimony?
Is there anyone who wishes to speak for or against the bill right now or any provisions in the bill? Welcome to the committee. Would you identify yourself for the record?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Eric Rudine with MnDOT Government Affairs, and this is Peter Zuniga, also for MnDOT, who's a data practices attorney on staff. And if we could, Mr. Chair, we'd like to talk briefly about the design build provision that is included in the Senate bill but not in the House bill. That would be on page R29 and R30 of your side-by-side. It's section 65 of the Senate bill. Mr. Chair, I don't know if
that would be on page R29.
Correct. Mr. Chair, I do have a handout if we could distribute these. I think there was some, thank you, there was perhaps some concern on the House side about the way that section was written and that it was somewhat difficult to understand when data became public. And so we've prepared a sort of a flow chart to show when data become public at various points in the process. And you'll see that when a project is awarded, all of the data do eventually become public. And one of our goals, actually, in rewriting the law that governs design build data is to make more data public earlier in the process than it currently is. And the main reason we're attempting to do that is because contractors were concerned that they did not have the ability to file protests if they were an unsuccessful bidder on a design build project. And in order to file a protest, they do need access to some of this information. And so it was our desire to enable them to file these protests, and that's why we've rewritten the design build section of the Data Practices Act as it pertains to MnDOT projects. If I could maybe turn it over to Mr. Zuniga to add anything.
Would you identify yourself for the record?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Peter Zuniga. I'm with MnDOT's Office of Chief Counsel. Like Mr. Rudine said, our intent in rewriting the design build statute is really to take into account all the data that is generated in that bidding process and determine at what point in the process it becomes public. Really, there are, I think, four events within the process, and after each event, we would like to make certain data public.
Are you speaking in favor of the Senate position then?
Mr. Chair, yes, we are.
All right. Any discussion regarding Section 65? Representative Holbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Rudine, is there any same or similar language moving in the House this year in any of Representative Beard's bills? Or?
Mr. Chair and Representative Holbert, no, there is not. This provision was introduced last year. It did pass the Transportation Committee last year to civil law, and in the Senate it was passed through the Transportation Committee and the Judiciary Committee, and was sitting on the Senate floor in a standalone bill by Senator Rest, and then was also included in this omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Holberg, has the House had any discussion on the design-build modifications like this at all?
Mr.
Or did they reject the proposal?
Mr. Chair, we did have discussion. I know that I'm trying to sort out Transportation Committee design build discussion, civil law. And we've had a lot of discussion over the years around this issue in particular, the process for selecting the contractor for the 35W bridge became very controversial, and I think that spurred an attempt to, you know, look at the process and the language. And so I know there were some concerns in the House, but we'd certainly be willing to take another look at this language.
Would you want to make action on it today, or would you feel uncomfortable about advancing it today?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm a little unclear what the process is going to be today. Historically, we have taken testimony from anybody that wants to express mm-hmm. concerns or support on language on either side of the bill, and then generally we would recess to the call of the chair and try and work out what we can work out. So
okay.
I'm
just
planning on being here all day today. I don't know what other people's doing.
Just so you're aware, we have members of the Judiciary Committee. Most of the ones that are here for this bill are here for the conference. Then we have a judicial hearing in our committee starting at 11:30. Then at 1 o'clock we have a caucus. And that caucus, I would expect, will run quite late. So if we can make our decisions now, that might be something to do or consider. Or we'll have to come back in the early evening, I think, to get it all resolved. So just so you're aware of our timetable here today.
Thank you.
Okay. Is there anyone who wishes to speak on this particular aspect of the bill? For or against on Section 65. All right. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Anyone else who wishes to speak about the bill? Welcome to the committee. Would you identify yourself for the record?
Hello, Chair and committee members. My name is Kirk Kadelka. I'm the legislative director with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And I first want to apologize. I've only been able to talk to a select number of folks on the conference committee on this issue. It's something that was raised within our department at a late time in the process here. It's on page of the side-by-side R45. It's dealing with the employee of contractor and subcontractors and their private data. And this is our concern is how this would be implemented. A number of our contractors, especially in our remediation division, dealing with cleanup of public property and private property, at times the information that's used, we can have on record the contractor, it may be their main business number and address or phone number for one person, but it may be the rest of the crew or subset of the business that is dealing with individual homeowners or business owners when they're going out to test soil samples or air samples within a home or doing the remediation activities on the properties. A lot of times what we find is happening is the contractor will give to an individual person their cell number. And in this day and age, a cell number is often their work number, their home number, and their personal cell number. And it's that collection of data there and that intermingling. And when we do have to give out contact information to the public for these folks, that information is sometimes hard. I mean, it's something we have to give out to the public, but it's hard up front to designate all the employees of all the cell phone numbers or their emails that they've been using. So that's our concern with this provision moving forward. In the past, we have a number of pieces of data with cell phone numbers, emails, which, again, are their public and private numbers. Going back in a data privacy request would be very difficult for us to determine what those are. I know there's been suggestive language by other departments and staff on making this only go into effect from a future date, which would be very helpful when we're dealing with information requests on cell phones and emails that were previously collected. That would be very helpful, but those are our two concerns at this point. Thank you.
Thank you. Any comment? Hearing none, thank you. Is there anyone else on that section who wishes to speak for or against that provision? Thank you. Ms. Brace.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm just going to speak about three different
sections.
Would
you identify yourself for the record,
please? Yes, thank
you.
This is my name is Twyla Braze. I'm president of Citizens Council for Health Freedom. And I'm just going to speak to three different sections. One is the Social Security number. And we, of course, prefer less of a Social Security number than more of one. The other thing that we prefer is the House language when it has to do with creating, maintaining, et cetera, data. And the Senate has a lot of those as new terms in their bill, but we prefer the House, which does not have those terms.
You don't like our Senate language?
Sorry. I do not, Mr. Chair. And then the last one has to do with on page R47, lines 34.11, 30.11, and lines 34.13 through 16. From our perspective as a health freedom organization, we have watched insurance companies, government, and others who want to know about the behavior of individuals, including gun ownership. And there are questionnaires in the doctor's offices asking about gun ownership and those sorts of things. We don't know who could possibly be doing this research or how the data could necessarily be used for rating or underwriting by the insurance companies. And so we have concerns with the idea that personal information on who, you know, goes hunting, et cetera, is used. So we would prefer the Senate language in that case.
I'm sorry, you would prefer what?
The Senate language in that case.
Senate language.
Which does not have the provisions for research or for insurance companies.
All right. Representative Holbert.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Braze, can you let us know how DNR licensing data would have a gun or health data? This, to my knowledge, it's like fishing licenses and boat ownership and
it's hunting.
Hunting, fishing. So this is data held by the DNR on its licensing program.
Right.
Ms. Braze.
Mr. Chair and Representative Holberg, and I'm sorry I hadn't mentioned this to you before, but I had not seen this section. But anyone who goes hunting has a gun. So that's our concern, is that that could be part of the research and part of the underwriting by the insurance companies and the research by whomever chooses to do research, whether that's the Department of Health, who has the collection of medical information on us through a different database or not. So I've only just seen this language, and now I'm trying to put two and two together for what the possibilities are that you might consider.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other comments? Thank you, Ms. Braze. Anyone else who wishes to speak for or against the bill? Welcome to the committee. Would you identify yourself for the record?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Nathan Morocco. I'm the director of the Employee Insurance Division at Minnesota Management and Budget. I'm here to just provide a couple brief comments about the portion related to the dependent audit, which is part of the House provision but not part of the Senate provision. I'll keep this brief, but essentially,
do you have a page number or a section or article number?
You know, I don't have the side by side.
Last page.
My apologies, Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry.
Related to that provision, back in the special session of 2011, the legislature had required that the state employee group insurance program, which is a program that you all belong to, be required to perform an audit of all the dependents within the program. And that audit was to result in a savings to the program of roughly $10 million, of which the legislature was able to book about $1.7 million in savings that went towards the final budget settlement. This provision essentially is repealing portions of the dependent audit but leaving other portions in. So it keeps the requirement for us to continue to provide the $1.7 million in savings, but it eliminates the requirement that we perform the audit. It does allow the use of a vendor as part of that audit process, but it prevents the vendor from collecting any information that's deemed private as part of that process. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, this audit is largely already complete. We only have 9 days left. The official deadline is May 11th, so we're about three quarters of the way there. So really the primary issues for us would be that there still is the requirement for the $1.7 million that we have already contracted for these services. So while there is a repeal in terms of the requirement to utilize a vendor and some stipulations on what that vendor can and cannot do, we already have a contract in place for $400,000 for that vendor to perform these services, and they largely have been performed. So we would be required to pay the $400,000 for them to carry out the services. And it's also unclear what impact this might have to other parts of our organization. We contract with health plans that also look for fraud. They may do claims review and look for unusual claims, maybe claims coming from out of state, or unusual patterns that might indicate that somebody is on our program fraudulently. And as part of that follow-up, then we ask them to verify or to ascertain that these folks are eligible to participate. So it's uncertain whether or not we would even be able to do certain kind of claims reviews in order to identify fraud. So with that, Mr. Chair, happy to answer any questions you may have, but those are our primary concerns.
Any questions? Mr. Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Simon.
Thank you. Mr. Morocco, thanks for coming. This is an issue that I think we need a good bit of discussion about. As you know, an amendment went out in the House on a voice vote. It passed, you know, on a bipartisan basis with at least audibly very strong support. And the issue, as I'm sure you know, is there are legislators who, and their families and others in state government, who feel, frankly, a little put upon by some of the requirements here. And at least anecdotally, I've had several members from both sides of the aisle approach me, and I can only assume have talked to other members of the conference committee about this. The idea that in the name of preventing fraud, which is a good thing, and that we all want, they're having to produce not only very private information, they feel, but also information that's very difficult to obtain. There's one member, a very senior member of the House, who is now on the verge of not being able to renew her husband on her health care because she can't find her marriage certificate. She just can't find it. It's decades old, and she's going to have to – she told me as of yesterday or 2 days ago that – that's it. She's going to have to she can't have her husband on her health care anymore. Or people who feel as if they have to submit tax returns, other private information. Now, I've spoken with a representative of the company who's doing this, and I understand that there is language in the instructions that indicates it need not be a tax return. And if it is a tax return, almost all of the financial information can be redacted, and that, you know, something as simple as a utility bill or a mortgage statement would suffice as well. I understand that that's there, but that message isn't getting out because the people who have approached me and the people who made the argument on the House floor, Representative Rukavina and others, are just really worried about how intrusive this has been and how difficult it is to obtain the information. So when I hear talk about savings to state government, I believe me, there's a question in here, I promise. But When I hear talk about the savings to state government, absolutely, we all agree we should be rooting out fraud, and we should be rooting out people who shouldn't be claiming certain benefits. But if the savings is coming from making the requirements so onerous and difficult that law-abiding, honest people aren't able to find documents, if that's where we're getting the savings, that our colleagues or anyone in state government is just throwing in the towel because they can't find the documents, I don't know if that's the kind of savings we want. So I promised a question, so here's one. The simple question would be, can you address any of that or all of that?
Mr. Morocco.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I guess, as I saw it when this law passed in 2011, that it was primarily a policy decision. And I think in your statement, essentially what you're asking is there a balance perhaps between the ability to verify dependents and is the process that's in place so onerous, or how does that weigh against ultimately the savings that are in the program? I think ultimately that is a policy decision. It's been the policy of the CGIT program ever since it was in place is that we had an affidavit process. And so we would ask employees to essentially ascertain that these are the dependents and they are indeed eligible. If we became aware or had reason to believe that somebody may have an ineligible dependent, then we would perhaps pursue some of these kinds of documents as a means of verification. So the process itself isn't necessarily unique to what CGIP has been doing, but it would only be on an as-needed basis. And so typically we would see maybe a handful of times in any given year where we may ask for these kinds of documents. And so that was our preferred method, and certainly that was sort of how we presented our opinions when this law was being created in 2011. But again, I see this strictly as really purely as a policy decision. I think once this audit is complete, and as I've talked to some members of this committee, I think when this is done, we will know the kinds of members that are potentially ineligible. We'll know whether they're spouses, whether they're children, whether they're ex-spouses, children, stepchildren, anything like that. We will also be able to ascertain a much more specific cost-benefit analysis related to the potential loss of those dependents. And I guess what I would offer is with all that information then in front of the legislature, then that's truly where you can then make that policy decision about the trade-off between the potential savings versus, the sort of the intrusive nature of the documents required to prove eligibility.
Mr. Chair, if I may. Simon. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Mr. Morocco, could you just walk us through a little bit the how will this work in the next couple of weeks, since May 11th is kind of the end date? Let's say that this legislator who's been married for decades can't produce her certificate showing that she's married. So what happens? At what point, if any, does she lose that dependent care coverage? When would that decision be made? Would it be weeks? Would it be months? Would it be immediate? And that that's relevant to a couple of amendments I've had drafted here. And members, I think, have they been handed out yet? Okay. Just to get the conversation started, and Mr. Chair, you tell me whether this is premature or whether we should wait for other issues, but I just wanted folks, since we're talking about this, to see. I have an A15 amendment here, which basically would say no one can be denied enrollment because of a failure to produce the applicable documents. That's one approach we could take, at least until next year. We could gather the data, who was able to provide what, and then make a decision when we come back in 2013 about what to do with that data. And maybe the decision will be that for those for a certain subclass, that's it, they're out. So that's one amendment. And then the A16 amendment, which we really haven't discussed this sort of sub-issue, just verifies that if there's any sort of security breach, that because people have been providing what they perceive to be very private and in some cases intrusive data, that if there's any sort of breach, a stolen laptop, someone hacks into a database, something, that they will be notified if that happens. That's what A16 does. So I'm not going to offer them at this time formally, Mr. Chair. I just and I'll go with whatever you want to do. But just in terms of the discussion, could you comment back to my original question on the timeline here, just so we know what we're dealing with?
Mr. Morocco, do you have any comments about the A15 or A16 amendments?
Sure. Would you like me to address that first?
Yes.
Okay, Mr. Chair. I think to the A15, I think one of the challenges with that provision is that we would expect folks who have ineligible dependents will likely not submit any documentation. It's those that likely have eligible dependents, but perhaps can't get all the documentation together. Are the folks, I think, as you're addressing, representative, are the kind of folks that we want to ensure are not going to be dropped off. So I think a sort of a blanket preclusion from dropping anybody who doesn't submit probably doesn't get at the heart of what the dependent audit is about, and probably would not result in the kinds of savings that were originally projected. But to the representative's point, folks who have submitted partial documentation, we continue to work with. So we have many folks that the vendor is engaged with in trying to identify ways to provide additional documentation. In terms of the actual deadlines, the deadline is the 11th, but the drops don't actually occur until July 1st of 2012. So we will have a fair amount of time, at least a month after this deadline, to continue to work with the members, identify other forms of documentation that may suffice, and ultimately get those folks who who have dependents but perhaps just don't not have access to the right kinds of documentation, we will try to get them to where they need to be. Ultimately, there is an appeal process that we implemented. It was actually required as a result of, or that was very specific to the law, that there be an appeal process for members who are having difficulty getting documentation or who feel that they have legitimate dependents, but perhaps the sort of the formal structure and document requirements don't quite meet their needs. And so that's something that we will work with the vendor and internally. Mr. Chair, to the A16, admittedly, I'm not real familiar with 13.055, but at its first blush, I would say that this would appear to be okay. I think this is something that we would, require of our vendor anyway. If there were some kind of data breach, we would certainly have the full expectation that that be communicated in the appropriate ways. So be happy to take a look at that. But again, at first blush, I don't see that as being necessarily problematic. So, Mr. Chair, I think that addressed the two provisions. And Representative, did that address your timeline question?
One moment. Representative Scott wanted to jump in here.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if one of the representatives for the vendor would be able to answer a couple of questions.
Welcome to the committee. Would you identify yourself for the record?
Mr. Chairman, Paul Cassidy with Leonard Street and Diner representing HMS. They're the vendor for the audit program.
Yes, sir. Well, my question centers around what kind of data the vendor actually does need. And, for instance, do they need copies of tax returns, or are the utility bills sufficient? Those sorts of things.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Scott, I think if you go, I'm not sure if you have copies of this in front of you, but the instructions that are given to each of the participants in the CGIP program that were sent to each of you as participants, if you are in the program, outlined the various documents that were needed, and that the alternative to some of them, including the federal tax reform, was in fact some type of bill that shows your name and your spouse's name on the same bill. It could be whether it's a credit card statement or a bank statement. I would like to just point out a couple of things, going back to what Mr. Morocco said about last year's legislation. There was a choice that was made, and that was whether or not you wanted an affidavit-based program, which would have just people would have signed a document swearing to the fact that they have a spouse and that these are in fact their dependents. But a decision was made to have a document-based audit performed, and that required the department to ask for these types of things so that you had a much more thorough audit, and that's what really the fiscal note was based on as well. The fiscal note probably would have been much, much less if it would have been based on affidavits versus a hard document audit at that time.
Right.
Thank you.
Going back to Representative Simon, you had a follow-up question, and then we'll go on to Representative Holbert.
I did. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is more for Mr. Morocco. I hear what you're saying about the A15 amendment, that it's probably too broad in the sense of saying that no one can be dropped, because we probably do want to drop some people. I guess, is there a language that you think, just theoretically, tough question, I know it's a hypothetical, that maybe if we were to recess or take a few minutes, kind of a sidebar, that you think that the department could come up with that would strike that balance of not saying that no one can be dropped, but saying that we're not going to drop folks who are in the process of something, of trying to reach an accommodation. I'm thinking of this person who can't find her certificate of marriage. Do you think that's doable?
Mr. Morocco?
Mr. Chair and Representative Simon, I'm not sure. I'm a little hesitant because I don't know the scope of those folks that are going to be engaged without the I guess my primary concern would be this: if we have a significant number of folks that are engaged with us and we're delaying the potential implementation of the dropping of the dependents, that could ultimately affect the savings that are generated in the program. I would want to check, I guess, with our budget officers on what to do about that $1.7 million. Certainly, if we're talking a handful of people, that's not going to influence that issue. If it's hundreds or thousands, then that could be significant. That's just sort of off the top of my head. I understand, the problem that you're trying to solve. I guess the question I would perhaps ask back is a month and a half after the audit is complete, is that enough time to reconcile? I would assume most issues could be identified in an alternative solution proposed to, you know, to the member to provide additional documentation. I'm not sure what else, you know, we would do, let's say, 5 months from now that would be any different than what we would do in the, you know, 2 weeks after the audit. So, again, I understand the problem that we're trying to solve. I'm just a little hesitant because there was that specific dollar figure that was projected, and we have essentially assumed those dollar savings both as part of the budgeting process and as part of the ongoing financial projections for the CGIT program. So anything that changes that number will ultimately result in affecting agency budgets, and we will have to either raise premiums or do something to offset those dollars. So,
Mr. Chair, just one other thing. I think it bears repeating that, and I understand if a policy choice was made, and I certainly don't blame the vendor. I mean, there was an RFP. They're doing what they contracted to do, so I have no issue there. Again, if the savings that we're getting, and maybe this was just a problem with whatever was drafted in 2011, if the savings are from fraud, that's great. But if we're booking an amount of savings, and to get to that amount, we're in essence making it so hard for people who are legitimately entitled to this benefit to get that benefit, and that's how we're getting the savings, then I think we have to revisit the savings. I don't know if this is really the committee to do that in. This is a conference committee on the data practices bill, not a budget hearing, but I just want to be very careful that we're not achieving savings, whether intentionally or not, by kicking people out of benefits they deserve, and by doing that by erecting hurdles that they can't clear. That I guess that's my point. But I think Representative Holberg has some questions about how we got here in the first place.
Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and my questions are not for the vendor, but for the department and also for Ms. Beyer-Kapinski.
Is there anyone from the department that could come to the table?
Mr. Chair and Mr. Morocco, before the RFP ever went out, I began a dialogue with MMB. I do not believe that your department has the authority to request income tax records. You were told to do a document-based audit, but under the way we classify data in the state of Minnesota, you don't get it unless you have the authority to get it. And so I have over and over again asked for where the authority is for MMB to contract to request copies of income tax records from our employees, which is one of the most highly protected documents the government holds on individuals. And as of yet, I've never got a satisfactory response beyond the legislation that was enacted during special session. And just for Ms. Beyer-Kapinski, and looking at the A16 amendment, a number of years ago, we did pass legislation relative to security breaches, et cetera, and I'm just curious if the A16 is redundant to what we already have in current law. So, whichever one you want to go first.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, I'm Lori Beyer-Kapinski with the Department of Administration. And on your question, I think it is redundant but it's one of those instances where it is implied that the contractor of government is in the same shoes and is an agent of the government entity, so the same rules that apply. So any instance where a state agency has a contract with someone who is going to access private data or confidential data, the security breach notifications would apply.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Mr. Morocco gets to tell me how they have the authority to ask for private income tax records beyond the little paragraph in special session law.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I think there are two general statutes that relate to the operations of CGIP, the first being 43A.28. In that language, it talks about the enrollment within the program. It says the time, manner, and conditions and terms of eligibility for enrollment of persons eligible for state-paid or individual-paid life insurance, hospital, medical, and dental benefits and optional coverages authorized shall be determined and prescribed by the commissioner. The second component would be 43A.31, This is related to the administration of the program. Under Subdivision 1, General, it says the commissioner shall maintain records, prepare reports, and perform all functions necessary to carry out the intent of Section 43A22 to 43A30, which is essentially the CGIP statutes. Finally, Representative, maybe the other comment I would make related to that is that no employee is required to give this information. In fact, when you look, when you see our enrollment forms, not only related to this, but our general enrollment forms, whether it be for new hires or people who are experiencing life events, having babies, getting married, whatever, in there it states that no employee is required to give this information beyond that which is required by law, which typically tends to be the Social Security number. It's just that the consequence of doing so may be our inability to enroll a dependent. So if somebody ultimately chooses that this information, it's more important, their privacy is more important than the enrollment, they certainly have that choice to make. And again, the documentation here is in the instructions. It says you can provide the tax return, but it also says that you can show anything that has a monthly or quarterly household bill, statement of account, just anything that lists the spouse and is linked to that address and is linked to the employee's address. So we certainly recognize the sensitivity of the information being asked for, and through the vendor, they provided us what were sort of the standard forms that have been required of the other 9 states that they have performed audits on, as well as all the various private sector employees or employers, Walt Disney World and I know all the Hollywood actors have been audited as well. So we were really pulling from kind of industry standards as far as the kinds of documents we require.
Mr. Chair, if Ms. Beyer-Kopinski might react to their statement of their authority to have access to income tax records, given the general duties clause.
Ms. Beyer-Kopinski.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, I think this will be one of those issues that is very challenging. Data that comes from a legislative member in the hands of MMB is presumptively public. There is nothing that classifies specifically data provided by a legislator. Certainly your tax return, if it came from revenue, would have a private classification, as you've highlighted. When you submit that to MMB, it would be presumptively public. The Department of MMB believes that HIPAA would protect the information submitted as a part of enrollment. I haven't had an opportunity to further research whether or not that is true, but at some point, there may be a need for a classification of data that legislative members provide to the department, because I would look at it, generally speaking, as just presumptively public, as many of already the birth certificates and marriage license already are. So I think people have a misunderstanding of how much data would be protected in any instance here.
Well, and
Representative Holford.
Mr. Chair and Ms. Beyer-Kopinski, you bring up an interesting element, but I think we're looking at major problems in the health department now because the commissioner of health, using their general standard for the duties of the commissioner of health, has embarked on all kinds of, forgive the term, but good doer, do-gooder kind of stuff in the interest of public health, collecting, storing, disseminating, testing, data on individuals without consent. And we now have a court case, and we are trying to look at legislation to address that. And we have this pervasive, this is my opinion, run with it. Run with the general duties clauses of implementing whatever comes in under your purview, no matter what commissioner you are. And, if we get caught or tripped up, then we'll come back and try and fix it. It was my understanding that, that they, in the area of data practice, that you have to have specific authority to access or private information such as this. And so I'm a little frustrated with, where we get the general clause of, we have to implement health programs, and so we get to get your tax returns and give them to a private vendor. And if you don't like it, well, then don't have health insurance for dependents.
Any comment?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, Chapter 13 requires that an agency collect no more than they need to run their program. They have, MMB has statutory provision to run the program. How much they need to collect to run that program really, as you've highlighted, is up to them. And the provisions on whether or not they're going to collect private or confidential data on a Tennyson warning is where someone has the opportunity to walk away. And I understand your position that in many instances, how do you protect your privacy and walk away from those kinds of instances?
Well, and Mr. Chair, we just heard testimony from the department that they didn't need the tax returns. Mm-hmm. They could have requested billing statements with both names on it and not made this request. I shudder to think that the number of state employees that have provided unredacted copies of their income tax because they thought they had to. That's a disservice to the employees of the state of Minnesota, that their very private information is being collected and stored under the premise that it's vital to them keeping something pretty important to them, i.e., dependent health coverage. And, you know, we're not going to resolve this by 11:30 this morning, I can guarantee you that. But I think that the department has pretty much, you know, put their hand out. My understanding is that 1.7 was booked as a savings and this is $400,000 in cost. I think you're darn close to realizing whatever booked savings you did on it, but I'm to the point where I really don't even care about the money. I'm really sick of agencies thinking that they can do whatever they want with highly sensitive information because of some general authority clause and not getting the specific authority to do so.
Representative Holberg, in my own experience in filling out these documents, I looked for billing statements that would have both my wife and I on it. Anything, utility bills, credit card accounts, we don't have anything with two names on it, on the billing address. So I had to resort to a tax form. Now, if we take a big Sharpie marker and scratch off every number on that page, as long as the request is have two names on a piece of paper, is that sufficient? Or would my scratching off the data, the numerical data, the financial data, would that invalidate that form?
Mr. Chair, no, that would not invalidate it. The list of possible documents that can be included as part of this verification are all listed in the same section. So there's just visually, there's a singular box that says, what do you need for a spouse? And so it's not that we are putting, well, you know, in our main instructions, we want your tax return, but then somewhere deep in the rest of the documentation, we're saying, here's some alternatives. So it certainly would be our preference, actually, that folks, you know, find some other alternative other than a tax form. But to your point, in some instances, there just isn't anything else that exists. And so then the tax form then becomes the sort of the one of the solution that tends to be a catch-all. Related to that issue, however, though, is that we specifically in our Q&As, we say, must I submit the information on a financial document such as a tax return, submit all the information? And the answer is no. When you submit tax returns or other financial documentation, redact or black out all financial information such as dollar amounts. Always redact Social Security and account numbers from financial documents. And we're not looking for the full 20-page. We don't care if you're taking farmland deductions or anything like that. We're just looking for the front page that shows that, you know, you're indicating on your tax forms, you know, this is your status as a tax filer.
Mr. Morocco, what if the individuals, the couple, file separately and they wouldn't have a document that has two signatures on it? Does that create a difficulty for those individuals?
Mr. Chair, that's why we have multiple options for verification. Certainly you can file, you know, you can indicate that you're married, but, you know, file single. That can help add to the body of evidence that you are still married. And again, if for some reason the tax form it does not suit these purposes. That's why the other documents are out there. And sort of coming back to Representative Simon's point, that's really what the appeals process and what the vendor is charged in doing is. I think there will be some employees who, you know, we can put 10 different options in front of them. There may just be legitimate reasons why they can't meet those, and those are the members that we're going to work with through the vendor to try and find some solution, some way to identify them as being eligible.
I think there's a number of individuals in Minnesota that are independent business people. They file LLCs, and as a result of the LLCs, all of their accounts are in one name or the other, because it starts getting blurred, or a veil of corporate identity starts to get connected, and you certainly don't want that. So I don't know if when we created this policy, I'm not sure if we really gave it all the thought that we wanted. On this point, Senator Simon, I've got Senator Newman waiting in the wings.
Oh, no.
Senator Newman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Would the department accept as valid documentation for purposes of this audit, for instance, a deed to a couple's homestead, which is definitely public information, would contain both names, also would contain information as to where the real estate tax statement should be mailed, and most often is going to be the address of the home. It would also be have a document called a certificate of real estate value that would be filed with the deed at the time that the couple bought the home. Would the department accept, for instance, a copy of a real estate tax statement, which I think is public data, I'm not sure, but often contains both names of the spouses, contains the homestead designation of the property, contains the address of the property. Would the department consider accepting either of those kinds of documentation for purposes of satisfying this requirement? Particularly in light of what Representative Simon has brought up, is, you know, sometimes when people have been married a very long time, it might be problematic in finding the marriage certificate, and this seems to indicate that you have to have it plus other documentation.
Okay. Any other? Oh, sir, Representative Simon.
Mr. Chairman,
it was a
rather lengthy compound question. I apologize, but I am interested to know whether or not the department would accept those real estate type documents as proof.
Sure.
Yes,
Mr. Morocco.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Newman. Certainly, you know, the first place we would go to is the vendor, as the experts in this area. I think the kinds of documents that you have listed here sound very reasonable and sound. It would appear to be official enough and create the kind of verification that we would be looking for. But it really is HMS that's the experts in what these documents look like, how they work for, you know, for every state, because we have state employees. Despite being the state of Minnesota, we have employees all over the country. We've got them in D.C. and New York and California, and so I wouldn't know what those documents might look like coming from other states. So again, what I'm hearing sounds very reasonable. I think those are the kinds of discussions that the vendor would approach us as part of the appeals process and say, we believe that these documents, although have not been listed as part of your official dependent verification documentation, we believe that these are reasonable and we would recommend that you suggest. Or they may say, no, there are reasons why these can be easily duplicated or can be fraudulent, and we would recommend that you not do so. But again, what I'm hearing sounds very reasonable and certainly be the kinds of things that we would consider as alternatives.
Any other? Oh, Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On that point then, so as I understand it, at least in the written form, it's certificate of marriage plus one of these others. And so I wasn't sure whether Senator Newman was asking whether the deed document would substitute for Category 2 or Category 1. Would it satisfy the requirement that is now in place that requires the marriage certificate? I guess that's the issue, and I you hate to legislate by anecdote, but this senior legislator, who I won't name, but who has a New York accent and is very senior, has been married for several decades and can't find her wedding certificate. I'm not going to name names. She, what does she do? I mean, would a deed or something like that, would that satisfy the requirement for her?
Yes, yeah. Morocco.
Mr. Chair and Representative Simon, according to the way we've laid this out, it does require the marriage certificate as the primary component, and then the additional documentation supports the fact that you are still married. I think ultimately, again, through this appeals process that we have, I think that the sort of final backstop to all of this is that there will be an affidavit type of process if for some reason if just somebody falls through all the cracks and just can't can't obtain the right documentation, then there is sort of a default affidavit process that we would have that would ultimately, I think, in this particular situation would satisfy that circumstance.
Representative Holbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did MMB account for any additional costs to the state for grandchildren who are on dependent coverage? Because in that case, the only thing is the tax return that satisfies all that for them then going on public health programs as opposed to being carried under the state program?
Mr. Chair and Representative, I'm not sure if I'm clear about the question, but there wouldn't be any requirement for a dependent child or stepchild or adoption or grandchild, then the marriage component isn't necessary in order to cover, to cover non-spouse dependents.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative.
I believe that the tax return is required for dependent grandchildren. And so if someone were to refuse to provide you with a tax document, did the state contemplate additional costs to the state for children under the age of 18 not having health care and being put on a state program as a result of this audit?
Mr. Morocco.
Mr. Chair and Representative, no, we did not make those considerations in terms of the impact to other programs within the state.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Any further questions on this issue? All right. Moving on. Any further discussion? Anyone else in the audience who wishes to speak for or against the bill? We do have a number of differences on the bill. We've gone through those already. Not sure how to proceed right now. Do you want to further discuss the bill, or should we consider getting into the differences and resolving how we move on those?
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It looks to me, staff has drafted this this bill. Perhaps we should go over the new language, see if it's agreeable to those sitting around the table, maybe mark up the parts that still need work.
What
is your suggestion?
Do you have a number on that document for the record?
It would be the 1143A amendment. No. Oh, you didn't. Oh, okay. Okay.
Okay. The 1143 amendment is not yet available to the public right now. And I think what we'll do is we'll review these differences first. We've already reviewed the differences, but we didn't come to any conclusion or why we should go with one Senate version or a House version on some of the differences we had. Perhaps we should just go down the list. And if I could bring your attention to the R21 and 22 pages. This is the House sections on 37 and 38.
Chair.
Yes, Representative Simon.
Well, I'm happy to speak to that since it's a House position. I'm certainly not speaking for either of my other colleagues. They can chime in here as well, but speaking
these,
for myself.
These are regarding legal fees and defend legislature settlement agreements,
right.
That type of thing. That's House language only right now.
Right. So in the House this year, Representative Myra, and forgive me, I don't know who the Senate author would be of the companion bill. Oh, okay. Representative Hall. So it's had a great bill, which has accumulated a lot of support, I think near unanimous support in the House, that has to do with an issue that arose out of the Burnsville School District having to do with payments that went to an administrator as a result of some dispute. And taxpayers in the district weren't allowed to know under state law the reasons for that payment and the details of the settlement. And the bill, which has near unanimous support, says that taxpayers ought to know about that. So the idea here, and this was not my amendment on the floor, it was another member's, is, you know, as we so often hear in Congress and in other branches of government, you know, those laws ought to apply to the people who are making the laws as well. So the idea here with that bill in mind was to make sure that we're applying that same standard of public knowledge and accountability and transparency to the legislature as well. And so that's why I suspect that the amendment went on. I don't even know if there was a roll call for this amendment or not. I think the roll call, does anyone know, was even withdrawn. So it was pretty much of a consensus item. So that was basically the idea behind that, is just to be fair and apply those same kinds of laws. I think Representative Myra's and Senator Hall's legislation was the inspiration for this. Apply the same kind of thing to ourselves. That's it.
Mr. Chair, I know that afterwards I spoke with Representative Adkins because his language was maybe a little clunky of some of the nuances of timing and degree of disclosure. Make sure that you didn't inadvertently disclose maybe a legal strategy or individuals' privacy, et cetera. And so I know that staff has worked with Representative Adkins, and he confirmed with me that he had a different language to address some of those concerns. So we'd like the opportunity to get that language from him before we reconvene or whatever.
For the record, the Senate does not have any they have not made a position on this. There is no amendment offered on the Senate floor. And so this is we don't even have any public discussion on it. So I can't give any hint of what the Senate position would be right now. Certainly look at any new language that Mr. or Representative Adkins may offer, but at this point I just wanted to make sure that you guys realize that we have not had any discussion. I don't even think we've had committee discussion on this.
And Mr. Chair, we understand that, but I just wanted you to know, a commitment that I made to Representative Adkins to continue to work on this language, and I think that we should at least have the opportunity to review it in conference committee. It might be something you guys really like.
We might.
You might.
Okay, let's move on to the second one. That would go to still on R22. In the House, Section 39, and the Senate's, I think we have a corresponding language on the Senate position, too.
Mr. Chair, I can probably make this really easy. This was a bill that Senator Roebling and I shared, and the Senate language is fine on this one. It's just stylistic. And
Senator, to demean you, Representative Holberg. Representative Holberg moves Senate language. What is the reference section? It would be the section 1 or lines 1.5 through 1.17. Any discussion? All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion carries. Design build transportation projects on R29. This was Senate language. The House did not have any provision for it, despite the fact that it was quite lengthy on the part of the Senate. Is there any interest on the part of the House to accept the design build language in the Senate? If you don't have an opinion, we could move on and move on to the next one. You want to put it on hold for now? All right. Mileage-based user fee data. That would be on R30 and R32.
Mr. Chair, again, the House had very strong feelings against the mileage-based user fee program being implemented. There was a reason that we never gave them the data classification. Yeah. We can certainly have some discussions with Chair Beard and before we get back together, but I don't want to move to take it at this point.
All right. Anyone in the Senate have an opinion on this? No strong opinion on the part of the Senate. Is there a motion?
Just don't act. Keep going.
Let's not act. The other difference is found on R37 and R38 regarding energy programs and the limiting of Social Security numbers to the last four digits. House language is referring to the last four digits, and I think the Senate language, did they have the full Social Security number?
Yeah.
I personally believe that the less amount of numbers, or less amount of information on Social Security numbers is the better way to go. I don't know why we didn't catch that in the Senate. I would move the House language on that particular provision. Is there any further discussion on that? Hearing none, all those in favor in accepting the House language found on sections, would be the comparison of Senate Section 82 and House Section 67 to move the adoption of the House Section 67 language. Hearing no further discussion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, the motion prevails. One thing that we didn't get into a lot of discussion on is on R40, the Secure Communities Initiative. That's Senate Section 2 on R40. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This Secure Communities program is one that I believe is already going to be implemented whether we adopt this language or not. And, in fact, I think, I don't see anybody here, but I believe that they've already put this in place. There was, a timeline of some sort and where we could opt into it earlier, and now the time has come. Kind of we missed the boat on this one, mm-hmm. as far as is the way is explained to me.
As a little bit of history, the Senate did have a position on this. It was a position not only adopted in committee, but adopted on the floor of the Senate in the form of an amendment. So why don't we put that one on hold for now, and we'll move on to the next one, the subcontractor employee data. This is regarding the prevailing wage law issues, or I guess a limitation regarding prevailing wage issue. Senate is Section 11, House Section 22 on R45. There was a suggestion that there might be alternative language on this. Is there any one who would like to talk about that? Yes, Representative Simon.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'll defer to our chief author if she wants to talk about it. But I understand that there's been some language that's been blessed by all the stakeholders and is apparently okay with everyone. I have a copy of it, but I don't know if.
Well, let's kick that around if we have it. Representative Scott.
I believe it's. Hey, Jen. Page 9 of the bill, the amendment, 9.1 and following. These two.
Mr. Chair,
okay.
I don't believe the public has access. Do they make copies now?
Okay, the public does have copies. So this language here addresses that. Is that what you're referring to, Representative Simon? Or?
Yes.
The public does have a record of this?
Yes.
All right. So, Representative Scott, your language is on page 9, lines 1 through 8.
Correct.
Is that it?
Correct, Mr. Chair. Yep.
And how does this differ from the language that was originally presented?
Well, the original language created a firestorm on the House floor that I wasn't ready for. It narrows the scope of the language a little bit. Lines 9.5 and following is primarily where the language changes. A government entity maintaining data under the subdivision may share the data with another government entity. So intergovernment data sharing here for the function authorized by law, and it must be disclosed to a government entity or any person for prevailing wage purposes. And I don't know if the Senate's up to speed on this, but what I found out was that much of the determination of prevailing wage is done from one contractor or subcontractor checking up on another contractor or subcontractor on the wages that were paid. And so in order to verify that information, oftentimes they have to contact that employee to say, did you indeed get paid this amount? And so this language allows that to still happen, whereas the previous language would not have.
Mr.
Yes, Representative Holbert.
I don't know. I haven't signed off on this language, and I'm curious why we would have entered on or after August 1st of 2012. There's a whole lot of subcontractor and contractor data held, and it's right now it's being treated as all public, and to only give this protection for new contracts, how are you going to,
Perhaps, is there anyone from the department here that would be able to make comment regarding this provision? Would you introduce yourself again for the record?
Mr. Chair and members, Lori Barkopensky, Department of Administration. And the language around it applying to contracts entered into on or after August 1st was to address concerns that a number of departments, including the Pollution Control Agency, has highlighted as to investments they have made in scanning lots of files that they don't want to have to go back and redact 30 years' worth of records when they really, you know, don't know whether or not it is a personal information for an employee of a subcontractor, and they really aren't in a spot to be able to find out at this point and want to make sure that they've got the greatest transparency. But that on the going forward, they could change their practices to make sure that they are better able to then protect this data that you want to classify.
Right. Any other comment?
Well,
Representative Holbert.
Mr. Chair, I think we're giving a pretty broad carve-out for much broader than I think we need to. I would suggest that people work on language that says that, because this is just any language held by Dolly or whatever. If they got it before August of 2012, you're saying that all of that's going to remain public into perpetuity? Is that what this language says?
Ms. Byer-Krupinski?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, the way that one of the provisions of data practices is data is classified at the time of the request. So if you change the classification from presumptively public as it is now to private, that would require all government entities to go back through all of their records and redact it, you know, as into perpetuity going the other direction. So, yes, that is exactly the intent this is meant to get at, is this was all public before. It would remain so, and that people would get this protection going forward. So that is certainly the policy decision for you to make in consideration of the financial impact it would have to state and local government. And this, and MPCA is one example of that, and perhaps they could answer that as well.
A question I have, though, Ms. Byer-Krupinski, is on line 7, where the data must be disclosed to a government entity, that's government entity to government entity. But then the language that says, or any person for prevailing wage purpose. And I know it does have a qualification for prevailing the subject matter, but for any person, we know what the information would be limited to, but the person, is there any limitation to who the person would be? Is it anyone in the state of Minnesota? And just asking a question about prevailing wage.
Mr. Chair, the definition of person is pretty broad. I don't have the statute book right in front of me, but it is anyone who comes with that specific purpose. So government would have an obligation then to set up some process to say you, in fact, want it for prevailing wage purposes, and given that government is already subject to civil and criminal penalties for misusing that data, to be able to do that really well and ensure that that data is not misused for other purposes. Any person who gets it would also be subject to the misdemeanor penalties that are in statute, but that is how we would encourage government to run these programs. But it certainly could go to any person, as you have highlighted.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Representative Holbert.
One of the approaches the House tried to take in resolving this with the department, and we use this approach in other areas, is that the organizations that wanted to do, I believe they're called wage surveys, would contract with Dolly, and that Dolly would charge them the cost of actually sending out, so that no individual person would actually get the data, but rather that Department of Labor and Industry would facilitate the contact process through setting up a fee-based program whereby they would actually prepare the list and, you know, get the letter or information that needed to be sent out and actually facilitate that process to protect individuals' privacy. At least to this point, we haven't gotten any cooperation from the department to take that approach, but that was another option that was discussed, so that the actual limited purpose that people were so concerned about on the House floor, the ability to do that double-check process, would still be allowed to happen, but that we would give these individuals the protections that state employees have, that city, county, private employees mm-hmm. Have. And so
right.
We're really struggling with this issue, because this is where we are right now on this issue as a result of lawsuits and cases, and this thing has bounced back and forth over the last 4 or 5 years. And I think it is important that the legislature weigh in on it and end the confusion and set the policy. The problem is that, at least from my perspective, I don't think we have a good resolution yet.
All right. Mr. Rakowski.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman.
regarding this issue.
Regarding the specific suggestion that was just mentioned by Representative Holberg, the commissioner was made aware of that suggestion, and we don't support it, and we don't have the capacity to do that, is the message I got from Commissioner Peterson.
They don't have the capacity? What does that mean?
The amount, we have four we have four people who do prevailing wage investigations, and to suggest what Representative Holberg is suggesting would we just simply don't have the manpower to do it. It would create quite an administrative challenge for us.
Mr. Chair, you at this point, you obviously give this list to whoever requests it for whatever purpose. This seems more clerical in nature, in that you would determine a cost of mailing to us, whatever was going to be the list that you would send out. I don't view it as being a prevailing wage investigator type of function, but rather facilitating a mailing type of function.
Mr. Chair, Representative, this is one of the things we struggle with is since day one when enforcement powers were given to the department, there's this misunderstanding that we collect all prevailing wage data. We send out the survey every spring, but it's a once there's a contract with the state, it's a contracting agency that keeps that prevailing wage data. The only time we receive prevailing wage data is at the beginning of an investigation. And, of course, during that investigation, that is private. Oh. So what you're suggesting would actually be something that the contracting agencies, such as my colleague here and MnDOT and others, would do.
No, I think we have a pretty big misunderstanding here. I'm not into the whole way that the union works, so Representative Simon, please correct me if I'm wrong. But listening to the discussion on the House floor, what the big rub was is that unions can come in and get these lists and make contact with individuals directly, and what I understood was that they prepared a letter on behalf of the union to send to these individuals to, if you will, double-check. And so that whether there's a follow-up, in my understanding, would be with the unions or anybody that right now currently you're interfacing with just to give them a list. So I don't believe you get any more information as a result of it. The letter that would go out would be from Union A. And the response or the letter would be just like had they get picked up the Excel file and run the labels. You're basically, this would be a clerical function where the labels would actually be generated in your office. The return label would be the union or the, I mean, once it left your office, you would never have any involvement. It basically could probably be done at MMB or any, but anywhere that could do a more clerical function, so it doesn't, should not impose any burden on the investigative process any more than you have today when you hand these lists out to other people.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, the request for the double check, as you're calling it, wouldn't come to Labor and Industry. It would go to the contracting agency that's keeping the payroll record. So if I'm a laborer and I'm being paid laborer wages instead of being paid as a sheet metal worker, and some individual wants to inform me that I'm not being paid what I'm supposed to be paid, they would need to go, I'm using you as an example, to the Department of Administration to actually see what is being paid out, because the law requires the contractor send in bi-monthly payroll records, I believe. And what I'm trying to make clear, I'm not doing a very good job, is the only time we get those payroll records is when there's someone citing that a violation is indeed occurring, and then we have to go do the investigation. Only until then do we get the payroll records from admin. So if a contractor is doing a project at Minsky or for admin or any other contracting agency and is never challenged, we would never see those payroll records. And I'm deferring to the expert here, but this has been going on for 5 years. That's how I understand it.
Mr. Chair, if I...
Ms. Spire-Kropensky.
The prevailing wage statute requires biweekly payroll to be provided to a contracting agency like admin, like DNR, like MnDOT. It provides access by DLI should they ever need it. They can go directly to the contracting agency or the contractor themselves. But Mr. Ruskowski is correct. DALI is not maintaining this data. It is individual contracting agencies who do. And our understanding of how their process works is that unions can come into any contracting agency and then get this for prevailing wage purposes. They can either inspect it or copy it as it's public data right now, and then would be able to follow up and do whatever they want with it currently since it's public data. Once it becomes private data, then they would need some provision that allows they or anyone else who wants to do the legwork around prevailing wage enforcement to be able to do that. And what I was trying to describe earlier is that I think government then has an obligation, given that this is private data, to set parameters in place and to police that in a way to ensure that that's the only purpose. If you provide it for that purpose, then it is our obligation as government to make sure that folks who get it are only using it for that purpose and to be able to react should we receive complaints that that data is being misused.
The way I understand it is right now, all of this data would be considered public data. And the language before us, either in the original bill or in the provision that Representative Scott is providing, is to limit this information and kind of first classify it as private and limit it to specific subject matter. Am I getting this correct?
Mr. Chair and members, as Representative Holberg was early highlighting, this data was when the prevailing wage documentation request went into place. The data was presumed to be public. The advice that we looked at in looking at 1343 was that data around independent contractors should be protected. So those home addresses were being redacted or not collected by agencies such as admin. A court case, City of St. Cloud versus International Brotherhood and Design Electric, the Minnesota Supreme Court said that the employees working for a business do not get personnel data protection. That case triggered all the data remaining presumptively public. So that's what brings us to this policy decision of whether or not the employees of businesses should be given some kind of protection for their personal information. That is the policy decision. I want to just clarify the role that Department of Administration, we are a government entity who collects data and has data. In this, we've been providing technical assistance, as we do to anyone, on how do we have a statute that is clear as to who it applies to and addresses any financial or implementation concerns that you should be aware of and doesn't have any unintended consequences. But the policy of whether or not this data should be protected or not is really for legislatures and then agencies, you know, like DALI, who have a prevailing wage concern to be able to address. We are providing you technical expertise on what this language could look like.
Any other questions? We can lay this on the side for a while. You think?
Thank you.
All right, let's move on. Let's go to R46, Senate Section 14, House Section 62. This is regarding web notices of meetings. Ms. Pontius, could you explain the difference between the two provisions?
Mr. Chairman and members, the difference on R46, if you look at 31.24 on the House language, it refers to any regular or special meeting. And the Senate limits the posting requirement to a regular meeting. Now, this is a department provision, and my understanding is the point of this whole section was to have the web posting only apply to regular meetings because of the timing of special meetings, they couldn't meet the web posting requirement.
Ms. Pontius, tell us what a special meeting would be. Is that something of an emergency nature, or what is a special meeting?
Mr. Chairman, I'd have to look up the definition. I don't normally do open meeting law words.
Or since it's House language, maybe the House people could tell us what in their opinion, a special meeting would be.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, generally special meetings would be governed by a need to conduct some type of timely emergency. There's a whole, I'm digging into city council days, but there's a limited set of things that you can do to conduct in a special meeting. But I don't think that the 10 days works, because one of the components of a special meeting is I think you meet in fewer than 10 days, but I could be wrong.
So if it's an emergency nature, do we really want to have a 10-day limit on it?
Mr. Chair, again, I think special meetings are 3-day notice, and so it was a floor amendment, and sometimes you pick your battles on right. the floor, and so I think we're good with the Senate language on this one.
Right.
We'll try not to disclose who put the amendment on.
Representative Holberg moves Section 14 of the Senate language found on R46. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, the motion carries. Going to the DNR licensing data found on R46, we have two provisions, House and Senate. I think the House has a few more provisions in this language or exceptions than the Senate language.
Mr. Chair, I think this one might, some new issues were raised today that yeah. I'd like to at least take another run at.
Put a hold on it for
yeah.
now? All right. The CGIP dependent audits, have we, I don't know if we've resolved that either. Put a hold on that. And then the IRRRB data repealer found on R48.
And Mr. Chair, I don't know if the Senate has a major problem. There's a little sordid history with this, and this was a data practices provision that was inserted in a tax conference committee a number of years ago. And by repealing this provision, it would not mean that all of the companies or companies that did business under this proposal, their information would become public or whatever. It would mean just that they were treated like everybody else. With business data that, I mean, there's still trade secret protections, et cetera, but that, you know, this was nothing that ever went through civil law or data practices in the House, and it's probably caused some consternation for people up north. My understanding is that it affects just one company that's neutral on the issue.
Is there, are these companies, are they in contract with, like, a government entity or IRRRB? Or is that what it is? And because of the public connection, just like any other corporation, these contracts would be treated in the same manner as any other private sector corporation that would be involving itself with a government contract.
Right. And Mr. Chair, I've heard no testimony or any rationale why this particular situation should be treated different than any other in the state of Minnesota.
Anyone from the Senate have any concern about this language?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I certainly do not, and given Representative Holberg's explanation, I would move that we accept the House language.
Senator Newman moves the House language on R48, primarily House Section 70, Subdivision B. Any further discussion on this issue? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. All right. Well, I think we've gone about as far as we can go.
Mr. Chair, there is a whole bunch of same and similars. If we could run through those right now,
sure.
We could get staff pretty far ahead on getting a conference committee report, you know, moving, and then just resolve the handful of us
right.
that are hanging out there.
Would council like to bring us through those differences? Yeah, We have budget constraints, so the WD-40 isn't. But it was a good suggestion of Representative Scott's. I have to bring some from my garage later today. Mr. Carey?
Mr. Chair, so there are four sections that I would describe as not identical between the House and the Senate, but they're similar enough that you might sort of call them technical differences. The first section is on page R40. It's Senate Section 1 and House Section 9. This goes along with Senate Section 2 and House Section 10 on page R41. This is the sort of reorganization of the duties of government entities and designated who is a responsible authority and providing for data access procedures. So there are sort of stylistic differences between the two.
And, Mr. Chair, I've had an opportunity to review these. I'd be happy to move the Senate language on this.
On this section?
The House has redundancy in, you can see on page 41, lines 32 or 22 to 24, 29 to 31, and the 4.3 to 4.5 in making information available, where you'll see on page 41, subdivision 4, the Senate chooses to do an availability section that applies to everything else. So
Representative Holberg, you would move the Senate language on page R41, or starting at R40, and that would start where?
I'd defer to counsel that.
Council.
That entire section, I'd move the Senate language.
So, Mr. Chair, that would be page R40, Senate Section 1, and page, and also Senate Section 2, starting at the bottom of page R40.
Does everyone understand the motion? Hearing no further discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Mr. Carey.
Then, Mr. Chair, the next section where there's similar language between the two versions is starting on page R43, Senate Sections 6 and 7, and then House Section 16 is the sections relating to security data. The Senate just organized the language a little bit differently, and I think that staff recommendation would be to take the Senate version as opposed to the House version.
Representative Holberg moves language starting on R43. What would be that, Section 6?
Senate Section 6 and 7.
Starting on Section 6, lines 4.14 through R44 to through line 5.2?
No, 1.4.
Or, I'm sorry?
1.4.
5.14.
Correct. Yes.
Everyone understand that motion? Hearing no further discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Carry.
And then, Mr. Chair, the last similar language is the repealer on page R48. This is on the House side, paragraph A of Section 70. This is a repealer of Section 13.05, subdivisions 1, 2, and 8. And this goes along with the reorganization of the responsible authority designation and government entity obligations. The staff recommendation for this would be the House language because there'll be additional repealers in that section.
And Representative Holberg moves House language on.
So it'd be page R48, line 36.8.
Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Any further discussion before we recess?
And then, Mr. Chair, there's a whole list of sections that are identical between the House and the Senate. Would you like to, like, I could list all of them if you want to.
Why don't we do
them all right at once? So I'll just go through them really quickly, and if you have questions about any specific ones, we can stop. So on page R1, Senate Sections 1 through 8 are identical. Page R2, Senate Section 9 and House Section 14 are identical. Page R2, Senate Sections 11 and House Section 15 are identical. Page R5, Senate Section 21 and House Section 23 are identical. On R16, Senate Section 30 and House Section 31. R17, Senate Section 31 and House Section 32. R18, Senate Section 38 and House Section 34. R24, Senate Section 52, and House Section 42. R28, Senate Section 62, and House Section 49. R28, Senate Section 63, and House Section 50. Page R30, Senate Section 61, and House Section Senate Section 66, and House Section 51. Page R37, Senate Section 80, and House Section 64. Page R37, Senate Section 81, and House Section 65. On R38, Senate Section 83, and House Section 68. R38, Senate Section 1, and House Section 63. Page R41, Senate Section 3, and House Section 11. Page R42, Senate Section 4, and House Section 12. R42, Senate Section 5, and House Section 13. R44, Senate Section 8, and House Section 19. R45, Senate Section 9, and House Section 20. R45, Senate Section 12, and House Section 36. R46, Senate Section 13, and House Section 57. And then also on R44, Senate Section 10, and House Section 21. So all of those that I just listed are identical between the two versions of the bill.
Mm-hmm. So moved.
So, Representative, yeah, could you go over that one more time, Representative Holberg? Representative Holberg so moves the language specified by Mr. Carey. Gehring, I'm sorry. Gehring?
Yes.
My apologies. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed. Motion prevails. Anything we've missed?
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
If I might, can we just clarify what's still outstanding then? I have the subcontractor, the DNR, the lawsuit data, and the dependent audit. If there's something else.
Okay, subcontractor data. Secure Communities Initiative is still out.
Okay.
Design build subject is still out. Legal fees.
Mileage.
The legal fee language and notice of that is still out. And the CGIP dependent audits is still out.
And the mileage study thing, too.
The mileage?
Yeah,
That's correct. I missed that. And that's still pending. I think the best thing with our timetable. I'm hoping that we would be available for perhaps late afternoon. I don't know a specific time, but we can keep everyone informed on that. And so as a result of that, this conference committee stands in recess.
Thank you.
To the call of the chair.